Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? Are we good? It's great to see you all, and it's been wonderful to be here. I've been really blessed by my time here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try and not have too much feedback. And I want to give some recognitions. First, I want to thank Stan and Tom Boyle for inviting me here, and I want to do my acknowledgement slide at the beginning. So what I want to do is thank some people that helped me. Our University Relations Department, you'll see some slides from them, and I also want to recognize some people whose names you're going to see in this talk today. They've all kind of given me permission, more or less, to use their names and their stories. So without further ado. Okay, that worked. What I want to do today is take you on a little campus tour. My goal is to give you a view from inside the university. You guys are all ministers to the university, and I think one of the great mistakes that we can all make is to think that we know the university. When I first went to Kansas in 1986 for an interview, I had never been to Kansas before, so I didn't really have any idea what I was getting into. But I had some preconceived notions. This is a picture of Kansas in the Dust Bowl, and when you said to me, you know, Liz, you're going to the University of Kansas and you're going to interview there, my picture of what the University of Kansas was kind of like this, except you add a couple little Quonset huts in the front, you know, little tin roof shacks that maybe said KU on them, and I was pretty convinced that that's what I was going to be facing. I was a little concerned about the weather. You know, the whole tornado thing, I wasn't sure I was going to be able to go for that. And, you know, people told me that my faculty colleagues were going to be just great, but I was concerned about whether they might have, you know, the brains or the heart or the nerve, you know, to really kind of measure up. And so I was really surprised when I actually got to KU and visited the campus. I was surprised about what it really looks like. It looks like this. This is a picture of our campus. The KU people are down in front, they're clapping. This is a picture of our campus looking off to the southwest. There's a beautiful little lake in the front that's called Potter Lake. And you can see some of the main buildings on campus there in the background. It looks like this. This is our science library, Anschutz Science Library, in the heart of the campus. It looks like this. This is Watson Library in a summer night under a full moon. It looks like this. This is the main drag through the center of campus. Jayhawk Boulevard is the street that you can see going through there, and you see some beautiful museums. Dyke Hall is the one to the left, and Spooner Hall is the one to the right. If you have really good eyes or are sitting in the front, you can see the football stadium off to the far left back in the mist there. And sometimes it even looks like this. This is the Campanile, the bell tower on campus during a winter ice storm. We had one of these ice storms earlier this week that prevented me from getting to you on Wednesday because these are, as you can see, spectacularly beautiful, but they're not really very good for driving. So we have a quite beautiful campus that doesn't look anything like the Dust Bowl. And so what's really surprising to me and continues to be surprising to me is not that my preconceived notions of Kansas or of the University of Kansas were so wrong, because I'd never been there before, but that they are so persistent. Even after nearly 20 years on this campus, when you say Kansas to me, what still comes to my mind is Dorothy and Toto, the tornado, and the Dust Bowl Kansas picture that I showed you at the beginning. In the same way, we all carry around preconceived ideas about what the university is, what the students and faculty are like, what life on campus is like, what factors drive this institution that we've been called to minister to. To minister effectively on the campus, you have to first try to really understand the campus as it is today. So in this talk, what I'd like to do is take you on a tour of my campus. You'll see lots of gorgeous pictures of buildings and students, courtesy of our University Relations Department. You might be surprised that these pictures were taken in Kansas. Our goal, though, is to try and look behind these great PR images, some of which we all carry around so fondly in our heads, to try and get a glimpse of the real university. So our goal today is to go off in search of the real you. We're going to start at this place right here. This is a place that's right at the center of our campus, right on Jayhawk Boulevard. This building is called Strong Hall, and it houses our university administration. Off to the right-hand side of this picture is where the provost and the chancellor have their offices. The dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences has his offices off to the left, and the graduate school has offices in this building as well. One of the stories, apocryphal perhaps, about this building that I really, really like is that it was actually erected backwards on the site. So you're looking at the south face of the building. Stories, legend has it that the building was actually supposed to be constructed the other way, that this was supposed to be the north side of the building. And I think that's kind of a little telling about how university administrators sometimes get things about 180 degrees backwards. One of the things university administrators worry about, and one of the reasons we're starting here, is they worry about something called headcount. That is, they care about who's on the campus and how they're distributed among various groups. So this is a little picture of our headcount on the University of Kansas Lawrence campus as of the fall 2003. You can see this pie here, and as you might guess, the biggest piece of this pie is our undergraduate students. Undergraduate students at KU Lawrence account for about 64-65%, nearly two-thirds of the campus population is undergraduate students, and that's some 20,000 people on our campus. Graduate students account for another 19%, about 6,000 students. And what might surprise you is how the last two pieces of this pie are distributed. The next largest piece of the pie is our staff. These are not IV staff. These are classified, unfortunately. These are classified and unclassified staff, people that range from janitors and food service workers to secretaries and research scientists and postdocs. That number of people is about 13% of our campus. And the smallest piece of our pie is faculty, less than 1,500 faculty, which is a lot of faculty, or about 7% of the total on our campus. What we're going to do in the talk today is we're going to visit with each of these groups. As we tour the campus, I want to give you a picture of what are some factors that might be influencing the lives of each of these groups on our campus today. So our total headcount, as that sign down there says, is about 30,000. First, I want to have you visit our undergraduate students. This is an undergraduate dorm on our campus. And one of the great myths, I think, of undergraduate life, even in a big institution like ours, is that undergraduate students live on the campus. My vice provost for student success, Marla Cerrone, who helped me with this talk, tells me that we have about 4,000 beds on campus to house students, and she tells me that that will house less than our freshman class. So this picture is actually not an accurate representation of where students really are. There's some great pictures here of what student life is like. You see students in the classroom. These are honor students working with a professor to look at a particular old parchment scroll, and so you see sort of this life of learning. Here are some undergraduate students in a laboratory, a molecular biosciences laboratory, learning through doing in the lab. And here's a student in a fine arts studio working on a painting and learning through the medium of the fine arts. Of course, all of undergraduate life, even in the great, PR world of university relations, is not academic. As you may well know, we are a little challenged for beachfront in Kansas. And so these two young gentlemen are working hard to do the best they can to find a little fun in the sun here. This is the Chi Omega fountain at one end of our Jayhawk Boulevard, and so they're paddling away happy there on a hot spring or summer day. We do have Greeks on the KU campus, and we're happy that they're there. These are some Kappa Deltas at a Twister tournament. And so I love this picture. I love the color and the life that's present there. Oops, we just lost. Let me back up, see if we can do better. We lost some images along the way here, but that's okay. We'll move ahead. In the midst of all of this studying and fun that you kind of get a sense of here, sometimes there are moments for quiet reflection, and so what you see here is a student actually studying under the trees now, and that does happen. But what I want to invite you to think about just a minute, those of you who are on campuses, I want you to take a second and think about what's missing from these great pictures of undergraduate students or from any PR pictures that you see of undergrads. What kind of pictures or images are not there that are really part of undergraduate life? And now I'm just talking about visuals here. Any guys want to guess? You can call something out if you want. The cafeteria is not there. That's a good one. Anything else? You don't see them eating anything. These people have to eat, right? Anything else? African Americans. Now, actually, unfortunately, on our campus, we have a very low minority population. My vice provost for student success tells me that she's very proud that we've increased our African American population from 3% to 6% in the last 5 years or so. It's been a tremendous amount of work. But the fact you don't see African Americans in these pictures is unfortunately because there aren't very many of them there. Let me tell you about two other images that you don't see in these pictures, and that once I show them to you, you'll say, oh yeah, that's part of life. You don't see any of these students in cars. We have more parking spaces for undergraduate students on our campus than we have beds for undergraduate students. Cars are a fact of student life on our campus, and we do not have a commuter campus. The other thing that you don't see is the ubiquitous cell phone. I asked my university relations department, I said, you know, this is what I see when I walk on campus today. I see everyone, all the students are walking around talking to someone who isn't there. This is a weird kind of transcendental experience. They're going through this thing and they're talking. When I did that, they said I was on drugs. And I asked our university relations department, I said, I really want to see a picture of a student on a cell phone. And she said, Jennifer, the person that was helping me, said, we don't have pictures of students on cell phones. And I said, why don't you have pictures of students on cell phones or in parking lots, for that matter? And she said, because the administration doesn't think that it shows a good image of our campus. Oh, okay. There's some other things that are missing, and not just these pictorial images of things like cars and cell phones. There's a picture that's missing that's been called a crisis in mental health. There's a the percentage of college students, according to recent reports, who report symptoms of serious mental illness, 33%. That are diagnosed with depression, 15%. That seriously consider suicide, 10%. That are taking psychiatric medications, 22%. For those of you who don't like the percentage thing, what this means is if you have a small group Bible study that has 10 people in it, 3 of them will have symptoms of serious mental illness. 2 of them will be taking psychiatric medications if these averages apply to your group. This person that you see in fine print at the bottom, Artie Cadison, is a director of student mental health services at Harvard, and he has called this a crisis in mental health, a crisis in mental health on the college campus. Those of us who are concerned about the souls of students might say that this crisis in mental health perhaps is a reflection of a crisis in spiritual health. Another little issue about students that's really striking to me, and perhaps is not striking to you because many of you are younger, but this is a real change from when I was on the campus, is that 4 out of 5 undergraduate students work while they are enrolled. They work 25 hours a week on average, and 37% of those students who work, that is about 30% of the total student body, are working 35 hours a week or more. That's real different than when I was in school, when students worked in the summer and they went to school when they went to school. Okay? Why do these people do this? Why are students working? They're working because their parents expect them to, and they're working because they need to pay for college. Our vice provost for student success, Dr. Roney, again said to me, I said, you know, why is this changed? Why is this different? She said, students can no longer earn enough in the summer to cover their tuition, so they need to be working year-round in order to just float the cost of going to college. Some other trends for undergrad students that Dr. Roney has talked to me about. We're going to see more students on campus requiring special assistance as the students that have been mainstreamed in K through 12 come through under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, come through into the university. And we're not just talking about students here with physical disabilities, we're talking about a generation of students with some significant mental disabilities, things like Asperger's syndrome, for example, that will be showing up on our campuses. Students are, according to Dr. Roney, identifying their sexual orientation more earlier, so they have identified as homosexual, for example, before they even arrive on campus. She informs me that the University of Kansas will have its first transgendered student in a dormitory next fall. And if you want to think for a minute about some of the challenges that go along with that, for other students around the student in the dormitory, that would be interesting. Another kind of positive trend, and one that I think is funny, is this idea of helicopter parents. And whenever I say the term helicopter parents to parents who are helicopter parents, they laugh because they recognize themselves immediately. Students remain much more connected to their parents while on campus than students have in the past. They're likely to call their mom or dad when on the cell phone, that other item that we mentioned earlier, when they get out of class to check up on what's going on or what they should do. So they have and universities are responding by creating parents' organizations to help parents stay more in touch with their students while still fostering a spirit of independence and autonomy in students. So this is a change on the campus. Students come onto campus now with a higher service orientation. They're much more interested in being involved in things like Habitat for Humanity and soup kitchens than students of the perhaps 80s generation. And students are much more interested in being multitasking than students were in the past. And for those of us who are lecturing faculty, this presents some interesting challenges because the student wants to multitask while listening to my lecture. So the student wants to talk on the cell phone and read Newsweek while listening to my lecture like I'm someone on TV. And this is unusual for faculty, but not unusual for students. So we have a little culture gap here that we need to try and address. Of course, all these statistics and stories don't really tell you the heart of what's going on with undergraduates. And many of you who are in ministry to undergraduates have a great sense of the heart of where students are. For many years on the KU campus, I taught primarily pharmacy students, and the material that I taught was pretty dry, how to calculate drug doses and things like that, pretty straightforward material. About 4 years ago, I did an unusual thing. I volunteered to teach an honors discussion section of Western Civ. This building that you see on here is a building called Bailey Hall, and if you have good eyesight, you can see that it says education. It's not really the home of the School of Our Education anymore. It's the home for a lot of our humanities departments who've moved in as the School of Education moved to better quarters. And this is the place where I got to teach my discussion sections of Honors Western Civ. Now, this is the first semester of Western Civ, and we're moving from the ancient Greeks and Romans up to the Reformation. And Christianity is pretty inescapable in this period. Okay, so we can't kind of walk around that. And the very first year I taught this was 2001, and I asked the students to write reaction papers in response to each of the readings that they did every week. So every week they would read Socrates and Plato and later Luther and all these great writers. And I still contain burned in my brain some of their responses, and I want to share some of them with you today. A student named Andrew said... I'd have poisoned Socrates too. That guy was annoying. And actually what he said was that guy was a jerk. And I said, you know, Andrew, way to engage the material. Can you say more about that? And so what he said was, you know, this guy was always asking people questions that he already knew the answers to. You know, I find that kind of annoying. And I kind of thought, note to self, Socratic method, not likely to be effective with this. Another student in the class is Meredith. She's the only woman in a class full of the rest were men. And Meredith is, I have a mental picture of Meredith that I just love. She came to class one day, she's a tiny little thing, and she wore dreadlocks. And she came to class one day in a short pleated skirt, great big boots, and as I got up close to her to hand back a paper, I realized that she had on an old Girl Scout blouse that, you know, looked like it could belong to somebody who was in third grade. And I thought, this is a wry commentary on fashion. So I loved Meredith's whole look and the way that she engaged this class. And Meredith was very articulate. And what Meredith wrote in this reaction paper was, on the Hebrew Scriptures, that was the reading for the week, she said, writing a reaction paper on the Hebrew Scriptures is like writing a reaction paper on the instructions for an automatic hand dryer. I said, Meredith, what do you mean by that? And she went on to explain that, you know, the Hebrew Scriptures to her were so familiar and so boring that you might as well be asking her to write about how to turn on the button on the air hand dryer that you find in the washroom. thought, okay. And then one of my favorite students of all is the student Ben, who I can characterize as... Ben is one of the last great angry young men, and I thought they had all died off in the 60s and 70s, but Ben was one. And he sent me an email one day, and he said, "Please excuse me from today's discussion of the Christian scriptures. I'm having personal problems, and I just can't deal with Jesus today." And so, you know, when I would read these reaction papers and comments from students, I would go into my office in the evening, and my husband would say, "You know, you got 10 one-page papers to read. How come it takes you an hour and a half to 2 hours to read these papers and put a check mark on the top? What's the matter with you?" And I would say, "You know, it takes me about 25 minutes to read the papers and put the check mark on the top, and the rest of the time is the time that I have to take to cry." So this is a little glimpse of undergrad students at KU. And I show you this picture. This is one of my favorite spots on campus. It's a little tiny chapel that's called Danforth Chapel. That's right in the middle of our main campus on Jayhawk Boulevard with some of the rest of this stuff. It's tiny. It seats about 50 people if you squeeze them in real tight. And one of the reasons that I want to pause here at Danforth Chapel on our tour is to say to you, you know, when I interact with these students, I have a sense of how hard your job must be, because a lot of these people have had just enough exposure to the gospel to be really thoroughly inoculated, and they've developed a real nice immunity. And so preaching the gospel to these folks, to folks like Meredith who say, "You know, this is so boring, I really just can't even deal with this," I think you really have quite a challenge ahead of you. The next group I want to visit on our tour is graduate students, and the building that I'm showing you here is called Simon's Laboratories. This is the place where I have my offices, where the Department of Pharmaceutical Chemistry is housed, and I interact with a lot of graduate students in my day-to-day life, and so I sort of chose this nice picture to show you, to introduce our graduate students to you. These are two women graduate students who are featured on our KU Women of Distinction calendar, and I put this picture up here to show you, at least in part, that the very obvious fact that graduate students are often older, and sometimes much older than undergraduate students, and because I'm a geek scientist, you'll see a slide about that pretty soon. This is Todd. Todd is a graduate student, and you hear all the KU grad faculty folks who came to hear the talk today say, "Ah," because they recognize Todd. Todd is a graduate student in physics and a member of our IV grad faculty ministry group. We have a combined graduate student and faculty ministry group on the campus. And if you look real closely, you can see in the background, I had to chop the picture so poor Linda got her head cut off. Linda, the woman in pink in the background, is his graduate advisor, and she's also a member of our group. And this is another graduate student working in my department now in the laboratory, hard at work on an experiment. This is the promised geek scientist graph. And the reason that I show you this is because I want you to have a sense of this age distribution. The curve that you see in red shows that students on our campus really have the expected undergraduate age distribution pretty much. Most of them are between 18 and 22 years old. There's a long tail on that curve, if you can see it, if you can see over people's heads to see that. But what I want to show you is there's an even broader distribution for the graduate student population. It's a smaller population, and when I looked at the numbers, 40% of our graduate student population is over 30. So we're talking about a quite different demographic here. This is one of my favorite slides in this talk. This is my graduate student, Steph. She was married to Jeff last October, and for those of you who are thinking about marriage, I would say that if you fall in love with someone whose name rhymes with yours, it must be true love for you to go through the rest of your life with a spouse whose name rhymes with yours. They will forever be Steph and Jeff, you know, so this is kind of how it is. But Steph and Jeff were married in this absolutely gorgeous Christian ceremony, and all the people in my lab group were invited to attend this service, which was wonderful. And after the service, I was standing with this student, Frank. Frank is from China, from Beijing. His Chinese name is Yun Song, and he chose the American name, the Western name Frank, which suits him beautifully. And so Frank and I were standing at the reception by the chocolate fountain, and he came up with his girlfriend, Su Min, and Frank said to me, "Dr. Top, I don't understand what's going on here." And I said, "Frank, you know, I really don't understand this either. This chocolate fountain is kind of a mess." You know, the kids are sticking fruit in there and they're spraying chocolate all over the place. The bride has on a white dress. What was she thinking? You know, this chocolate fountain thing is really, really kind of weird. And he said to me, "No, no, Dr. Top, it's not the chocolate fountain. It's the wedding that I don't understand." This is the first Western wedding that Frank had ever attended. And he said, "I don't understand the unity candle. I don't understand what the minister was saying. I don't understand what went on there." And I thought, okay, we kind of had a nice conversation about the unity candle. I could handle that one. But what happened in the service? Do I talk about marriage as sacrament? Do I talk about marriage as covenant? Do I cover all these theological issues standing right there by the chocolate fountain worrying about the fallout from the chocolate fountain? You know, so I did not do a very good job of explaining to Frank what some of these issues are. Len Andyshak, who's the person on our campus who does international student ministry, can tell you many similar stories about how we really have an opportunity to minister to international students. And on our campus in particular, international students are disproportionately represented among our graduate student population. So this is a wonderful opportunity to do cross-cultural ministry. I have, in the course of my nearly 20 years at Kansas, let me see if I can give you a partial list of the countries. India, China, Taiwan, Scotland, Italy, Denmark, and even places like Texas, which is... as we know, a whole other country. So we have a real opportunity to minister to students from around the world, really right in our own backyard. The next group that I want to introduce you to is one that is near and dear to my heart because I'm a faculty member and because my involvement with InterVarsity's faculty ministry work group has been a tremendous blessing to me. I'm a little, you can tell by this point in the talk, I'm running a little short of buildings that have specific significance for these groups. And so this is a building that I just wanted to show you because I wanted to show you the building. This is our student union, which doesn't really seem to go with faculty at all. But it's a wonderful building where there are lots of student services. And when I was a new faculty member, here's the lame tie-in. I used to eat my lunch here every day, so that's why I'm showing you our Kansas union. Now I want to... Thomas is actually here. He's down in the front. So I want to introduce you to two faculty on our campus that I have been blessed to know. And the first one is this person, Thomas. Thomas is a professor of political science at KU and a political philosopher. Thomas is Canadian. I saw some people out here with roots where, so I knew Thomas would feel at home. Thomas was raised in Alberta, and his parents emigrated actually to Canada from Eastern Europe, if I have that right, probably at the level of his grandparents' great-grandparents' generation. I'm not sure I have that chronology exactly right. Thomas did graduate work at Duke University. I know we have some Duke people here, before coming to be a faculty member at KU. Thomas's research is involved with the intersection of religion and politics. In particular, Thomas is a pacifist, and he's interested in the, right now, particularly in the work of a man named John Howard Yoder. This is a book jacket that shows a book that Thomas contributed a chapter to. The title of the book is A Mind Patient and Untamed, Assessing John Howard Yoder's Contributions to Theology, Ethics, and Peacemaking. The reason I chose this particular book, Thomas has written other books that he's the primary author for, but the reason I chose this book was twofold. First of all, I could get a nice image from Amazon.com. And the second is that I think the title, A Mind Patient and Untamed, describes not only John Howard Yoder, who's the subject of the book, but also is a great description of Thomas himself. Oh, and let me back up just a second. One of the things that I find most fascinating in that about Thomas is that Thomas has been cited as an example of a Christian scholar on a secular university campus. That is, someone doing Christian scholarship on a campus that is not a specifically Christian campus. If you go out to the bookstore and pick up George Marsden's Outrageous Idea of Christian Scholarship and turn toward the back, you'll see George Marsden recognize Thomas Heilke as an example of this kind of person. And when I read George Marsden's book, I was completely thrilled and said, that's our Thomas. You know, that's our Thomas, a representative of Christianity on the secular campus. The other person I want to introduce you to is a dear friend and colleague, Taruna, who's a faculty member in my department. Taruna is a pharmaceutical chemist, a chemist by training. Tarutta was raised in Indonesia. He did his undergraduate work in Jakarta, and following undergraduate work in Jakarta, well, actually, let me mention this now. While he was an undergrad in Jakarta, he was involved in the resistance to Suharto. After he left Indonesia, he did graduate work at the University of Arizona, and then subsequently did postdoc work at the Scripps Institute in La Jolla. After some industrial appointments, yeah, so he has a really nice pedigree. After some time in industry, he came back to join us. And Tarutta's work is involved with this molecule. Those of you who are former students of biochemistry will recognize this as a ribbon diagram of a protein. Those of you like Cam Anderson who are more artistically inclined will recognize this as great art. This is a wonderful picture of what we think the structure of this protein looks like. And the protein is of interest because it's a kind of molecular Velcro that works to stick cells together in various different tissues in the body. And Tarutta is interested in the other thing that this protein is good for is that it's a recognition element on many different proteins in the immune system. Tarutta's work is involved with trying to use that recognition element to target drugs specifically to cells in the immune system. And that can have fantastic consequences for treating autoimmune diseases, everything from diabetes to multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis. So he's doing some incredible and fascinating work. I want to back up to this slide on Indonesia a minute, because one of the points I want to make here is that Tarutta has a fabulous testimony, a fabulous story of a faith journey. At the time Thomas's family was in Eastern Europe, Tarutta's family was in the mountains of Indonesia, and they were part of a tribe called the Batak. And the Batak were having their own encounter with Christianity by eating missionaries. The Batak were cannibals, and until the arrival of a missionary named Nomensen from Portugal, the Batak had pretty summarily dispensed with the missionaries that had been sent to them. Nomensen, at the level of Tarutta's great-grandparents' generation, was quite persistent in dealing with the Batak, learned their language, and ultimately appealed to them on the basis of their love for education to convert to Christianity. That was a part of the whole process of Nomensen's call to them. As I said, Tarutta then, through this call of his great-grandparents' generation, traces Christ in his family back to those generations, and he traces every step of his journey from his undergraduate days in Jakarta to his graduate work in Arizona, how he got there, to his postdoc work at Scripps, which was not the postdoc that he would have chosen for himself. He sees God's hand in absolutely every aspect of this, preparing him for this work that he is doing now. Tarutta is an example of a Christian scholar on the secular campus, but you will not see him mentioned in George Marsden's book. You will not see him mentioned in any other book on Christian scholarship, because most of our work on Christian scholarship concentrates on Christian scholarship in the humanities. I want to invite you today, all of you, to open your minds to have a broader concept of what Christian scholarship might be. Jesus is Lord of all of life. Jesus is Lord of all of scholarship. Let's claim Jesus as Lord of scholarship in the sciences and in the humanities as well. I show you this slide as a sort of little transition to some of the next topics about faculty that I want to show you. This is to remind you that faculty are people too, and faculty have kids. And two of the people in this slide, the two on the left, are Willie and Elizabeth. Willie and Elizabeth are the children of Carrie and Jean, who are members of our grad faculty group. And what they are doing in this slide, if you can look closely, is, and I got this from the Department of Chemistry website, where Carrie is a faculty member. What Willie and Elizabeth are doing is they're playing with something called a spectropulter at the KU Department of Chemistry's Carnival of Chemistry. Now, what a spectropulter is, you know, you probably don't care, and we don't need to go there, and we don't need to talk about that. Suffice it to say that if you think being a preacher's kid or a missionary kid is weird, being a faculty member's kid is also weird. How many of you have ever played with a spectropulter? Willie and Elizabeth are doing this because their dad is a faculty member. So I want to invite you to remember that faculty members have families. This is the part where my colleagues from our grad faculty group here in the front need to get out their Kleenex, because these are some old pictures that Bob Clark was kind enough to send me of our grad faculty group. And I could not leave the faculty section of this behind without talking about how meaningful our grad faculty group has been to graduate students and faculty on our campus. At its peak, we probably had 60 or 80 people routinely showing up for monthly gatherings, so this is a large group. This is a picture of a monthly gathering. You can see Debbie Clark on the left side. Yep, she's here in the front today. Right next to Debbie Clark, you can see a photo, very tiny photo of my husband's foot. He served on a faculty panel, on a faculty spouse's panel, and he doesn't like to be shown in public. And the rest of these are people that are listening to this talk. This is a couple of graduate students working on a Habitat for Humanity project. This is a group that is a Virtues Writing Project group. A bunch of us got together for a period. Well, there's my husband, so those of you who know him know which one is him. I won't identify him to the rest of you. But a bunch of us got together for a period of about 9 months to take on the project of each one of us taking on a different Christian virtue and writing an essay about it and sharing it with the other members of the group. Now, we probably didn't produce any great literature, but we certainly became a lot closer by this shared experience of scholarship in a different kind of community than we usually experience. This is some of our grad leaders. Many of these people have graduated and moved on to greater things now. And I show you these last two slides because I want to make a point. This is a picture of some folks at a picnic. We start off the beginning of the year with a picnic at Carrie Johnson's house. This is Carrie in the faculty, the obviously faculty member here. And these people, you can see that they're all eating. And the last thing I want to show you again is a picture of kids. The person you're laughing in the front is Thomas, who's the father of the kids standing in the yellow shirt with his arms raised. That's Tius. Tius is now looks exactly like that. He's a high school student, and he looks like that, only he's twice as big. Many of these kids of our grads and faculty have gone on to college and universities themselves. This is a book discussion group that was part of our grad faculty ministry monthly gathering for a while. They were meeting to discuss C.S. Lewis. One of the things that I wanted to show you in these two slides about food and kids is that we did a recent poll. Amanda, who's one of our student leaders, did a poll of us in a recent monthly gathering, and all the people present were asked, what things in this ministry group would you not change? Okay, so some of you are going to be kind of disappointed, you know, in the answer to this, but the two answers were, oops, we like it that you feed us, and we like it that you involve our families. And that might seem pretty disappointing to a bunch of ministry people who are probably hoping for, you know, right theology and you know, a clear declaration of the gospel. But I think this speaks profoundly to the nature of faculty life, that we are often cut off from our families in our daily work and asked to be apart from them a lot of times. And the fact that, very simply, we are fed when we come together with this university group is profoundly meaningful to many of us. Okay, the last group that I want to take you to visit on our tour is staff. And again, these are classified and unclassified staff on our campus. They are a larger group than faculty. They outnumber faculty by about 2-1. On our university, staff are an often neglected group. When it comes time to talk about raises, they're often the last people to get raises. When it comes time for representation, they're often the last people to be represented. And so I want to talk to you about staff today to encourage you not to forget them. And I want to introduce you to four different staff people who are meaningful to me. This is Nan, who is a secretary in our department. And I show you Nan in her office because I think it's an interesting commentary on what her life is like. Those of you who are sitting close can maybe see that down here in the corner, she has both a heater and a fan. Nan works in an office without a window and that has really poor heat and air conditioning. And so she has both a heating unit and a fan to try and control that. You can see on her desk is a mug. What you can't see is that on the other side of the mug it says, the boss. And she really is the boss. She runs the department. And without her, we would all be lost. And the other thing I want to show you is right up here on one of the shelves, you can see that there's a picture. Nan is a single parent and has lots of pictures of her daughter on her desk, but that particular picture is a picture of former graduate students. They are as close to Nan as family, and she keeps the picture up there because she likes to be reminded of what wonderful people they are, and it's an indication to me of what a nurturing role she takes in the lives of graduate students in my department. This is Carrie. Carrie is a staff person in the School of Education. Carrie is also my teacher. I've had the privilege of sitting under Carrie's teaching in a women's Bible study at our church for many years now. And Carrie recently joined the university on staff, and she is an exponent for the gospel every single day. She talks about the gospel to graduate students. She talks about why she tells her son there is no Santa Claus to graduate students and faculty. She also represents the gospel in other kinds of ways, and she asks specifically that you pray for the woman that's seated to her right, the woman that's in a black and white striped shirt. This is someone that Carrie is ministering to, and she asks that you pray for her, and I'll skip the details, but if 1,300 university staff workers pray for this other staff member that Carrie is ministering to, who knows what might happen. A different kind of staff person is represented in this picture. This is Dave. Dave is an NMR spectroscopist, and if you don't like to say spectroscopist, you can call him our campus NMR guy. Our campus NMR guy is really special to those of us who are in the sciences, and he's shown here with his prize possession. This is an 800 megahertz nuclear magnetic resonance spectrometer, which is a big honking magnet that is so powerful that it has to have its own building. Dave is a PhD chemist. And not a faculty member, he's a research scientist, a research staff person. This is a very different kind of staff person than the two other ladies that I showed you. And the last person that I want to show you is Barbara. Barbara is a postdoc and might be called in some circles an emerging scholar. She's likely to go, Barbara's from Ireland, she's the one seated, not the one standing. Barbara has earned her PhD already and is getting additional training and will probably return to Ireland to a position of some importance there. So I show you these four pictures of staff people, and that doesn't even cover the breadth of what staff do on our campus. They are food service workers. They are janitors. Some members of our administration are technically classified as staff. I want to encourage you to recognize this group on the campus. I want to encourage InterVarsity as a whole to not exclude staff from your ministry on campus. So when Tom Boyle talked to me about this, we're nearing the end of this little tour. When Tom Boyle asked me to do this talk, he said to me, I said, well, Tom, what do you want me to talk to them about? And he said, tell them what God is doing on campus. So I think of this as a kind of my final exam. This is my final exam. So the question Tom posed to me is, what's God doing on campus? And my initial response was that of any student who is poorly prepared for the final. Oh my gosh, I have no idea. I didn't study this. God doesn't check in with me before he does something. I have no idea what God did, and I am going to fail this final. But I forgot who I am for a moment there. And while Stan said that I was not raised in a religious home, I was raised Roman Catholic, and it's true we weren't a real religious bunch. For the last many years, I've been hanging out with a bunch of Calvinists. And while you might take exception to some of what the Calvinists think, there's one thing that they have absolutely straight. The Calvinists have a firm conviction of the sovereignty of God. And I've heard many times from the pulpit that there is absolutely nothing that happens that God has not ordained or allowed to happen. So the answer, Tom, to your question, what's God doing on campus? I remember my Calvinist sermons. Everything that's happening on campus is what God is doing on campus. Absolutely everything. Stem cell research, mental health crisis in undergraduate students, Christian faculty where you would least expect to find them, financial crises, staff workers, absolutely everything that is happening on campus is what God is doing on campus. And I encourage all of you to embrace the whole campus. Learn as much as you can about the campus, because in learning that, you will learn what God is doing on the campus. We're coming to the end. This is our last stop on the tour, and some of you may recognize it from the ice storm picture at the beginning. This is the Memorial Campanile that you see, the bell tower that you see in the middle of the picture. And the other building that you see, sort of the squarish building off to the left, is Spencer Research Library. This is a really special place on our campus, not because it's a research library and a bell tower, but because it features, it's featured prominently in our commencement exercises. And the way commencement on KU campus goes is like this. First of all, students who talk about commencement don't say, "Are you going to graduation?" They say, "Are you walking down the hill?" Because going to commencement exercises for us is about walking down the hill. And the way it works is this. The faculty line up on the porch of that squarish building that you see there. And the students line up by school or college on the drive that you see that's called Memorial Drive. And so there'll be big banners for the School of Pharmacy, School of Fine Arts, School of Engineering. There'll be students lined up all over this drive, and the drive is closed because we have 5,000 or 6,000 students graduating at a time. And they will walk through the campanile and down the hill into the football stadium through a double row of faculty that are called a faculty gauntlet lined up on the stadium and then into the stands. One of the things that's interesting about this and that you can see better here than in the next picture is that it's tradition on our campus for students to walk through the double doors of the bell tower at the bottom on their way down the hill. Now, think about it. We got 5,000 students that are going two by two through the bell tower. And this is a two-hour operation. And so, but there are students who will say, "By golly, I paid my tuition, and I am walking through the campanile, and you cannot stop me." So this is what the campanile looks like on a calm fall day. This is what it looks like at commencement. And you can see the black line of graduates walking down the hill in two different rows. We have the traditionalists on one side and the non-traditionalists on the other. Students are permitted to skip that walk through the campanile thing if they want. And so those are the people coming down on your right, and the people coming down to the left are the ones who said, "I am walking through the campanile." The other people that you see here up in the stands in the football stadium to the right and surrounding them in all the bright colored clothing are their family and friends who are high-fiving them and taking pictures and clapping them on the back as they walk down the hill. This kind of atmosphere prevails at our graduation ceremony. It's very definitely a happy occasion, not a solemn academic occasion. There are lots of balloons and streamers and happiness all the way around. Even our chancellor gets into the act. This is our chancellor, Bob Hemingway, and he wears the straw boater to protect what you can't see, which is his basically balding head. And so on a fine spring day with a blue Kansas sky and a prairie breeze from the southwest, there's no finer graduation ceremony anywhere, none with a truer sense of place. These graduates, as I said, will file through the campanile and down the hill through the crowd of their family and friends. They walk through that double row of faculty in the football stadium and up into the stands. Our chancellor, Bob Hemingway, who's before you now, wisely avoids the temptation to pontificate. And he confers the degrees and his congratulations with sort of a minimum of frou-frou. Hats are thrown, hugs are exchanged, gowns are returned, and then they are gone, as if the prairie breeze had simply blown the graduates away, out of the university and into their lives. Of course, the myth of commencement ceremonies everywhere is that undergraduate students are the only ones who leave the university. Graduate students ultimately finish their degrees too. Faculty move on to better positions elsewhere, as do postdocs and research staff. Our chancellor did not begin his faculty career at KU, and he is by no means required to finish it there. Intervarsity fellowship groups formed in this environment of leaving may thrive for a time and then dissolve as the members and even the IV staff move on. I can tell you from experience that this can be extraordinarily painful. But I've come to see it like this. A campus fellowship group is a little like this dandelion puffball, beautiful but transient, seemingly destroyed by the slightest gust of a Kansas wind. But you know, you can't kill dandelions. They'll spring up in the darndest places, far away from where they started. Your work on the campus, or rather, God's work through you, has far-reaching effects as the students and faculty you minister to spread out into the world. If you look closely in this picture, you can already see new dandelions growing in the background of the photo. An African hymn that I learned from my son says this, Ishe Alua Kole Bajeo, which means God's work can never be destroyed. Thank you for your ministry, for your love for Jesus and the campus, for your love for the people on the campus. Thank you for growing such beautiful dandelions on the lawn of the university. God bless you.